Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's got to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And for the next hour, they're going to be the views of H.P. Alberelli, and he has written a fascinating book called A Terrible Mistake: The Murder of Frank Olson and the CIA's Secret Cold War Experiments. Now, for those of you who have never heard of Frank Olson, and I'll have to admit the name wasn't familiar to me at all, but I do remember certainly reading the stories of MKUltra and all the experiments that the CIA was doing with LSD back in the early 1950s, and certainly the drugs were being circulated across America, there were people who were taking LSD, and they thought they could fly, and certain people were jumping off cliffs thinking they could fly, getting all sorts of hallucinations. And then a story came out, and I think it probably came out during the church hearings, about a CIA agent who actually had taken a dose of LSD. Apparently had been given to him inadvertently, a sort of a joke or an experiment. We never knew how, and he jumps out a window and kills himself. And that was the story that I had always believed during the years, and never gave it much of a thought. And certainly the CIA apparently had poisoned one of their own, and he jumped out of a window, and that was it. But our guest, of course, had gotten onto this story and had come up with an entirely different interpretation, and because the family was convinced that Frank Olson, the father, had not simply jumped out the window, but that there'd been some skullduggery there. Why Mr. Alberelli actually spent, 10 years researching this story?
Yes, sir. How are you? I'm good to be with you tonight. A little over 10 years.
A little over 10 years. Well, I'm going to let you tell this story because people hear me talk all the time. You must have had a fascinating experience, tracking down this story and finding out what really happened to Frank Olson, because the implications of this story are so far-reaching. And I can remember reading back in those days about a city over there in France where a lot of people had gotten poisoned because they'd eaten flour that had been poisoned with ergot, and but you hear all these little things, and yeah, a lot of people died over there and went crazy with that ergot poisoning. Terrible, terrible thing. And but you just sort of file this around in the back of your mind. You never think of it again, but you help to connect a lot of the dots. You pick up the story.
Well, I did. Thank you very much. It took quite some doing, and as stated, it took a number of years, a little over 11 years, and for the most part, it was enjoyable research. The subject wasn't always enjoyable, though, because there were a number of quite shocking and incredible experiments that were conducted in and around Olson's work as performed at Fort Detrick for the CIA. But not to hold listeners in suspense, what I found was that, without doubt, Olson had been murdered, and I was able to actually identify the two people that murdered Olson on behalf of the CIA in November of 1953, when the majority of people believed he jumped out the window of the Statler Hotel in New York City. It was actually a case where he'd been thrown out the window.
And, of course, is what is so incredible, that this has been covered up, and when you actually brought this information forward, why, it was totally ignored, or pretty well ignored by the mass media. If it hadn't been, I saw an article someplace, and but the Triune Books had published your story, I never would have known anything about it. Well, hang on, they're going to be back here in just a moment as we explore this incredible story. You go right ahead.
Oh, you want me to?
Yeah, why don't you just keep right on talking?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we were taking a break. I'm sorry. No, Trine Day should be patted on the back for publishing the book. Actually, more than patted on the back. Should really be thanked by most people.
Now, basically,
did you try to get
other firms, other publishers?
Well, I did. I worked with a couple agents who were very excited about the book initially. But within anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks, that excitement rapidly dissipated after they encountered a number of New York publishers who weren't keen at all about touching the book, and they were very reluctant to even explain to me the reasons for that reaction.
Well, did they explain to you that the people who in the publishing houses didn't want to lose their jobs?
Well, I think that's a lot of it, and I think a lot of the publishing houses and the mainstream press have been pretty well infiltrated by the various intelligence services in the United States. So it's difficult to maneuver around them and get anything published that tells the truth about the CIA or the Army or any of their intelligence apparatus. It's just very, very difficult.
And I think this is what the average individual really doesn't understand, is that there are people planted in all the major publishing houses to prevent the truth from coming out. I know I had a good friend of mine wrote a book called The Medusa File, excellent book, and he'd written, I think, 10 books before that, all gotten published, and suddenly put The Medusa File out, and basically nobody would take it, and he couldn't understand until he got a call one evening from one of the publishers, an editor for a large publishing house, and said, that's a great book, you got to get it published, and my friend Craig Robert said, well, why won't you publish it? The fellow said, I'd lose my job. Don't you know that there's a fellow from the CIA assigned to this company, and if I were to publish that book, I would lose my job. And ladies and gentlemen, this is what we are really up against in America, as incredible as it seems. Freedom of the press means if you control the publishing houses, you have the freedom to suppress whatever you want to, and I fear it's going on today. Well, anyway,
you're exactly welcome
to the real world, Hank.
Well, thank you. No, what you're saying is exactly right. It's remarkable. I'll give you a good example. In 1975, when Olson died in 1953, but in 1975 it was first revealed to the press, to the world, and to his family that he had been dosed with LSD.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Sydney, our guest is Hank Alvarelli, and we're talking about his book. Basically, he had several people, agents, who were going to shop his book around, get it published by the major publishing houses, and none of the major publishing houses would touch this book. Why? Well, because I will tell you why. It's because the CIA has agents in every major publishing house in this country. Now, you say, how could you say that? Well, very simply, because the head of the NSA said that, Lieutenant General William Odom. If you haven't read his book, Fixing Intelligence, came out in 2003, and of course, he couldn't tell us what was going on. General Odom couldn't, but he could ask questions like, should the CIA have journalists planted in the media to control the access of information? Should the CIA be assassinating people? He didn't tell us they were doing that. But he simply asked the questions, very pointed, and I know from personal experience, they have their agents planted every place, and fortunately, Triune Press went ahead and published this. We know the people there are on pretty good terms with them, but they were actually got this book out. It's beautifully done. It's Trine Day published, certainly it will be available. We will carry the book because we want you to get it out there, the listening audience. Go right ahead.
Well, it's interesting what you say about the press, the media, all media outlets being dominated by the Central Intelligence Agency, and it's true. And besides the gentleman you just quoted, William Colby, who at one point was head of the Central Intelligence Agency, actually made a statement and said that any media outlet in the United States of any worth, the agency had somebody working within. So nothing could happen in terms of news being reported or books being published or even movies being made without the agency knowing about it beforehand.
And Colby, unfortunately, went for a canoe trip at the middle of dinner and never came
back.
But
that's right. Mr. Colby paid a price, I guess, for saying that. And the interesting thing is, and I go into some detail in my book about it, is Colby disappeared, actually, the same week that the New York District Attorney sent him a letter in the Olson investigation that was revitalized in the 1990s. The letter was mailed on, I think it was a Tuesday morning, and the following Thursday or Friday evening, Colby, according to the conventional story, decided to go canoeing after sunset and disappeared for a week, and then his body washed up on the eastern shore a week later, and the story is he had drowned. Of course, the body was so decomposed there wasn't much that could really be discovered. But back at his house, his dinner was half eaten on the table. The radio was playing. His laptop was open to work that he was doing. So it appeared more than obvious to his neighbors that he'd been yanked out of the house rather quickly and disappeared for a week before his death was discovered. And again, it was the same week he had been requested to testify in the Olson case before the New York District Attorney's Office.
All right, fine. I think Colby was an honest man. I think he was going to spill the beans on this whole thing. I think a lot of people were very upset that they killed Frank Olson. Now, basically, why don't you give this story? Certainly you were saying that it really wasn't many years after Frank Olson's death when the family finally learned that their father, Frank Olson, who had worked for our Defense Department, who had actually been given LSD before he jumped out the window. So how did they find that out? And then, of course, what happened after that?
Right. Well, the way the LSD was found out was that in 1975, when after Seymour Hersh published a series of stories in the New York Times concerning CIA domestic abuses, President Gerald Ford, who had just taken over the presidency from Richard Nixon, appointed a Blue Ribbon Committee that was really a dog and pony show, and it was headed up by Nelson Rockefeller. And the charge that was given to that committee was to further investigate CIA domestic abuses and to give the President, Gerald Ford, a report and to tell him how he could correct these activities and prevent the CIA from conducting any further illegal activities in the United States. And of course, anyone that's delved into the history of the agency and the history of the Rockefeller family would know to appoint Rockefeller to oversee that type of activity was kind of appointing the fox to oversee the hen house. Rockefeller, since the early 1950s, when he had been appointed by President Eisenhower to be second in command at HUD, had actually personally signed off on a lot of the MKUltra activity that was conducted initially by the CIA in the 1950s. But getting back to the story, when the Rockefeller Commission in 1975 issued their report, there was one line in it concerning drug experiments by the agency, and then it said that a civilian employee with the Army, the U.S. Army, had actually been dosed with LSD 9 days before his death and then had committed suicide because of the dosing. And it didn't even name the person, but the Olson family saw that report that was published in part in the Washington Post the very same day, and they knew, of course, they were talking about Frank Olson, their husband and the father of the family. And they reached out immediately for attorneys to represent them because they knew it was a pretty complex case. But nonetheless, they didn't suspect murder at that point in time. The only thing that really had them sort of reeling was the fact that he had been given LSD. And from 1953 till 1975, they didn't know that. Of course, nobody knew what LSD was in 1953. So they were going to sue both the government and the CIA for wrongful death, assuming that the LSD had provoked his suicide. And a remarkable thing happened. As a result of that, the President of the United States, Gerald Ford, did something no president that I know of had ever done, and that was that he invited the Olson family to actually come to the White House and to join him in the Oval Office and to have coffee and crumpets or whatever, and he apologized on behalf of the United States government and the Central Intelligence Agency for the family for what had been done to Frank Olson. What was going on behind the scenes was extremely interesting, though, because most people perhaps don't remember that in 1975, Gerald Ford's chief of staff was a guy called Donald Rumsfeld. And Donald Rumsfeld, his special assistant in 1975 was a guy called Richard Cheney. And behind the scenes, as President Ford was apologizing to the Olson family, Rumsfeld and Cheney were frantically writing all these memos to President Ford saying, well, they didn't really want Ford to apologize to the family or to even meet with the family. I think because they were primarily concerned that Ford might say a little bit too much. And Gerald Ford was known to often speak out of school and to sort of bumble things. But he didn't do that with the family, and through the Freedom of Information Act, I was able to obtain a number of the documents that Rumsfeld and Cheney had written to Ford concerning the Olson case, and it was revealed through those documents that what they were extremely concerned about at that time was that the media and the public would find out about the nature of Frank Olson's work in the 1950s prior to his death. And those memos even state that we have to do everything possible to hide the nature of that work from the public and the media, and even if it means paying the family off, which the government eventually did.
How much did they actually pay the family, do you recall?
They were going to pay the family $1.2 million. And then there was some trouble with a couple of Congress people, and the amount was reduced to $750,000, and that's the amount that was paid to the family. But as a result of accepting that money, the family had to sign a release that they would never sue again unless they could prove fraud on the part of the White House and the CIA.
Well, of course, the one thing was that the last thing they wanted was for the public to know the fact that it wasn't that simply Frank Olson had jumped, but the fact he'd actually been pushed, he'd actually been murdered, and he'd been murdered because, of course, the things he'd been involved in, and he was talking about those things. He'd actually made some remarks to people about how deeply he was concerned about what he'd done, and the idea that I've made a terrible mistake. In fact, that's the title of the book.
That's exactly right.
I made a terrible mistake. So do you want to tell our listeners what he had been involved in? Because I think this is the most fascinating thing.
Sure. Olson, let me give the lay of the land a little bit. Olson had been hired in 1942 to work at Fort Detrick for the Army. And most people might know that Fort Detrick is the chemical and biological warfare center for the U.S. Army and the American government. And he worked there for about 10 years until around 1950 the CIA came along. It had started a couple years beforehand and contracted with Olson's shop, with Olson's division within Fort Detrick, which was called the Special Operations Division, to conduct a number of projects that the CIA wanted Fort Detrick to do, and most of those projects revolved around drugs and assassination and the use of drugs for assassinating or incapacitating small and large groups of people. And as a result of that work, a number of field experiments were conducted.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. All right, Hank, go right ahead. You were talking about a number of field operations were done, experiments to see how these terrible drugs would affect people. So go ahead.
Right. As a result of the work Olson engaged for the CIA, it was decided that a number of field experiments would be conducted. And around 1949, the Army had first become aware of LSD. And that's really pretty early. I found that it actually happened in mid-1949, and traditionally it had been reported as happening much, much later, but I was able to come up with a number of documents that well evidenced that. And what both the Army and the CIA wanted to do at the beginning of 1950 was to test LSD on large groups of people to see how it could be used and what effect it had. There was even a thought that it could be used in a way that would replace the use of guns and bombs in a warfare situation, as ludicrous as that sounds today. So one of the experiments, there were two or three experiments were planned. There was one for New York City for the subway system, but that was postponed in 1950. And then in 1951, there was an experiment that was actually conducted in a small town in France. And the name of this town is Pont-Saint-Esprit. And roughly in English, that means the Bridge of the Spirits. And there's a very prominent stone bridge in this town. It's a town of about 10,000 people. That was actively bombed by the Nazis during the Second World War. But the Army and the CIA decided they'd conduct this experiment in the summer of 1951 with LSD in this town by placing the LSD drugs in what the documents read was a food product. And we subsequently were able to learn that the food product that the LSD was placed in was the bread that was delivered fresh to the town each day. This was 1951, and if you know France at all, bread is a very important part of the diet in France, a staple, and people, much like in the United States in the 50s, where we had milk delivered to our stoops, the French had bread delivered to their homes each day, and what they did was lace this bread that was delivered with LSD, and on August 17th, 1951, about an hour to 2 hours after everyone brought their bread in and started consuming it for breakfast, about 700 people in this town went stark raving mad, and they had no idea, of course, that their bread had been dosed with LSD. And five people before the day was out had committed suicide, and about 40 people, between 40 and 50 people, had gone so crazy that they had to be carted off to local mental institutions. And a lot of those people stayed in those institutions for months, and in some cases even years. And again, this was all a result of an experiment that had been conducted by Olson's division within Fort Detrick.
Now, basically, how many people were affected by this? You say a couple of thousand?
No, about 700.
About 700 people. Okay, fine. So basically, and that was the one they put this story out about, the air got poisoning. Was that
That's
right?
That's exactly right. The way that story got put out.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is one of the most fascinating parts of the program, was because back in about 1951, the military decided they were going to do an experiment with LSD on large numbers of people. So they went to a French town, little French town, 10,000 people, and they poisoned the bread. They put the LSD in bread, and apparently, suddenly there were several hundred people who went mad, 30 or 40 of them, had to be taken to mental institutions and stayed there for a long period of time, and a certain number of people, how many people died because of this experiment?
Five.
Five people died. So, but basically they had to put out a cover story, because I can remember this cover story, because I'm old enough, and they said, oh, well, it was ergot poisoning. It was ergot poisoning, and the ergot got, this is the fungus, got into the wheat. And that's why all the people who ate the bread, you know, went crazy, you know, ergot poisoning. So anyway, of course, this was a very successful experiment on the part of our military there and the French people. Pick the story up.
Well, and then when the incident happened and these five people died, four of them because, you know, they didn't know what was going on, and they thought they were actually going quite mad, and they killed themselves, the French authorities called in a group of scientists the same week this incident occurred to study the incident and to try to ascertain exactly what was going on. Nobody knew. Nobody had a clue as to what was happening. And the scientists they called in were from a nearby chemical company in Basel, Switzerland. And the chemical company was known then as the Sandoz Chemical Company, S-A-N-D-O-Z.
Aren't they the ones who put out the LSD?
Well, that's exactly right. The only manufacturer in 1951 of LSD in the world was the Sandoz Chemical Company. And the reason they manufactured it at that point in time is because they had discovered it about 10 years earlier, but they had no idea what to do with it. So at that very same point in time, they were actively trying to market LSD to both the CIA and the U.S. Army, possibly as an interrogation tool or as a weapon used in aerosol form. But, of course, they didn't tell anybody in the village of Pont-Saint-Esprit or the country of France that they had this product, and they had been actively giving it to both the CIA and the Army. And they came in and conducted this sham investigation and said, oh, the reason everybody went crazy in Pont-Saint-Esprit is because they ate bread that had been infected naturally through corrupted rye that had been placed in the wheat and then baked into the bread. And as a result of corrupted rye, you have an ergot process that can produce a product very similar to LSD. And of course that was a bogus story, and everyone bought it until about 10 or 15 years later, when the bread samples of the bread that had been retained were tested by independent labs, and it was discovered that there was no ergot poisoning at all in the bread. And then another excuse was manufactured that maybe it was mercury that had been in the water, and that was disproven, and then eventually it went down as a complete mystery. And anyone that's interested can go to the internet and find hundreds of articles about the mystery of Pont-Saint-Esprit extending back to 1951, and nobody knew what it was.
How did you find out?
Well, that's what I was just going to explain. I had no idea about any experiment being conducted at Pont-Saint-Esprit. I had heard about the incident, the same as you, that there had been this strange incident in this small town in France, and that it had been ergot poisoning, and I accepted that. But I did quite a number of Freedom of Information requests to the CIA concerning the Olson story, and in about the third or fourth batch of documents I got about, I think it was 4 years into my investigation, there was one document that had been put in to a pile of about 100 I received that concerned a meeting between an official of the Sandoz Chemical Company and the CIA representative. And it was an account of a dinner that had taken place about 2 months after Olson's death. And even though the document doesn't mention Olson, for some reason, somebody at the CIA had seen fit to put it in the pile that I was given. I think because it had been filed along with other Olson papers. And initially I read it, and my first reaction was, well, this isn't any good because it has nothing to do with Olson. And I put it aside, and about a week later I went back to it because I was curious to know why I had gotten it. And I read it very carefully, and I saw that the account of the conversation between the two men...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Hank. Edgar, right ahead. You're just saying you went back to this memo. You know, I've always felt, going into the background of a lot of the material coming out of the CIA, there are people in the CIA who want to get this information out. They can't release it. It could cost them their job, their lives, certainly. When you work for the CIA, you are not allowed to put that information out. They can send you to prison for the rest of your life. But I think that maybe sometimes there are people there who want to get the information out, and maybe they figured you'd be smart enough to pick up on it, and you obviously were. So what did you come up with when you read about this conversation that had taken place not long after Frank Olson had been murdered?
Sure. I know you're exactly right. I think once in a while when you do a lot of Freedom of Information requests to the agency that somebody on the other end will become involved that's an angel and will recognize that your attempt at getting the truth might need a little help on that end, and they'll slip something in. And I think that's exactly what happened in the case of this one document. But the document, when I went back and read it, proved to be a very remarkable document because it recounted the conversation between the CIA official and the Sandoz official and recounted the fact that the Sandoz official actually said, well, of course, you know that the secret of Pont Saint-Esprit is that it wasn't the bread at all that caused people to go crazy, and instead it was an experiment. And when I read that, I nearly fell off the chair. I thought, oh, my God, of course it was. You know, it only made sense that it was an experiment. He didn't go on to elaborate. But what he was trying to do at that point in time by reading the document in its totality was to sell even more LSD to the CIA because within a few more sentences, he said to the CIA official, well, of course, I know this secret, and I know you know this secret, and, of course, you understand that the Russians are trying to buy the remainder of the LSD stock we have, and we really don't want to sell it to the Russians, but of course we're in business to make money, so we want to give you first dibs on it. and it was less than a subtle marketing.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Hank is simply talking about what had actually happened, is that there had been a meeting between somebody from the CIA and somebody from Sandoz, and this was not too long after Frank Olson had been murdered, and the fellow from the Sandoz was saying they're the ones who produced the LSD, and they were the ones who were called into this French town, to actually cover up the fact that the CIA had poisoned the people there, put the LSD in the bread, and these people had gone mad and died, and many had gone to insane asylums. So the fellow from the Sandoz was just simply talking about the secret of what had happened in the French town and saying, I know what happened, and you know what happened, and the Russians want to buy the rest of the supply, and we'd much rather sell it to the CIA. And it was really a pitch to get the CIA to buy up the rest of their supply of LSD rather than let the Russians have it, but bringing up the secret of what had happened in that town. And that was the first inkling that Hank had, that, of course, the stories of the ergot poisoning that had been circulated to the people all across the world really were true. It was a cover-up for the fact that they'd poisoned the people in this French town with LSD and driven them mad. Go right ahead.
And so the question, you may recall how we got to this point. The question was, what did this have to do with Frank Olson? And what it had to do with Frank Olson as we've learned, is that he'd been working for both the Army and the CIA for about 10 years, and his job encompassed doing these kinds of experiments over and over and over again and working day in, day out, trying to find ways of either killing people or incapacitating people. And, of course, as you can imagine, that work plays on the conscience and the soul after a while. And Olson had made a decision in mid-1953 that he wanted to leave, that he wanted to get out of that work and do something else. And at one point in time, he actually told his wife that he thought he'd quit working at Fort Detrick and go back to school, even though he had a Ph.D. in biochemistry, and retrain himself and become a dentist and set up a dental practice in Frederick, Maryland. And that's pretty interesting because one of his sons actually went on years later to do exactly that same thing. So when Olson made that decision, at the same time, the thing that played against him is that as a person, Olson was a fairly confident man, but he was also very outspoken and very arrogant. And he had a real problem with authority, like a lot of people do today. And that wouldn't have been such a horrible problem had he not worked on one of the most secure, top-secret places in all of America. And to have a problem with authority working in such a site could be very, very problematic. And he took a rather naive attitude and thought, well, I'm getting out anyway, so I can go ahead and say what I want to say. And one of the things he said indiscreetly to somebody he should not have said it to, but the person went back and reported him to the Detrick security authorities, was he talked a little bit about the experiment in France, in Pau Saint-Esprit, because he had been there for that experiment and he didn't feel great about it. And the real concern on the part of the CIA and the Army at that point in time, in terms of that story actually getting out to anyone, wasn't so much that it would get to the media, because if anything, the CIA had a tighter hold on the media in 1953 than they even have today, but that the Russians would get wind of it. And of course, you know, this was the height of the Cold War, and if the Russians got information like that and used it on a propaganda basis, it could have been devastating for the United States and for all of our allies, to think that, you know, the CIA and the Army would actually target a small village in a country, you know, controlled by allies, could be extremely damaging media-wise. So what happened with Olson was when they dosed him with LSD, it wasn't just part of a casual experiment or a lark or a fun sort of thing that they had reported in 1975, years later, but it was actually an attempt to interrogate him. And in 1953, it was very, very common to use LSD and mescaline and other drugs in an interrogation setting. There was a project that was being conducted by the CIA, and Olson was very much a part of it, called Project Artichoke. And that ran parallel to the more famous project called MK Ultra. But Artichoke, in many ways, was even worse, because it was solely an operational program as opposed to MK Ultra being a research program. And the joint purposes of Project Artichoke were primarily enhanced interrogation, devising ways to control people, regardless of their religion or morals or principles, actually trying to figure out how to control people to do anything the agency wanted them to do. And then the third component was assassination. And of course, if you think, all those things sort of go hand in hand. If you can control somebody regardless of their principles or morals or upbringing or religion, then you can control them to the extent where they'll do anything you want them to do. And oftentimes with the CIA, that control led to murder. It led to people you know, being hypnotized and then assassinating people. And the thing that shocked me is a lot of the documents I got, after a while, became very routine. But initially when I read them, I was just shocked by the fact that over and over and over again, I read that the objective, the primary objective of these experiments was flat out trying to control people. We need to control people to do anything we want them to do, regardless of their personality, religious upbringing, morals, principles. And they spent millions of dollars researching how to devise that ability, and I'm convinced that they were very successful eventually.
Well, now, what about Korea? Was there any involvement between Frank Olson and the use of poison gas or certainly of chemical biological warfare in Korea?
Mm-hmm. From what I could see, that issue came up early on, and a member of the Olson family felt strongly about that. But I was able to get most of Olson's travel papers in his passport, and there was no indication whatsoever that he spent any time in Korea. In fact, during the Korean War, he spent a substantial amount of time in Europe. But many of the people Olson worked with at Fort Detrick did spend a substantial time in Korea. And while they were in the United States, they were devoting a substantial amount of time to devising and developing biological and chemical weapons that were to be used in Korea. Now, it's been very, very problematic proving that the United States did use biological weapons in Korea. There's a lot of circumstantial evidence, and there's people who have devoted their entire lives to conducting that investigation. But as of yet, nobody's come up with any strong evidence to that effect.
But, of course, the Russians have said, the communists have said that we did it. We've denied that adamantly. Yep. But then, of course, you'd expect them to deny it adamantly.
Right. I suspect, my feeling is, reviewing a lot of the documents concerning things that Olson's colleagues worked on, I think on a small basis, we did engage some biological warfare there. And a couple people, they're both dead now, unfortunately, told me that was true, but it never got beyond the use of placing it in balloons, like hot air balloons, and having using the balloons to disperse it, and when the intent was to use it in military airplanes. But it never got beyond the balloon stage, that there were all sorts of problems with it. And it wasn't until after the Korean War that Fort Detrick was to really able to devise it so it could be used anywhere. Right now, as we talk, the situation is so advanced technically that the United States could use biological warfare in any given situation against any enemy with disastrous results.
Well, now, how did you finally get the CIA agents, a couple of ex-CIA agents, to come forward and tell you the truth about the murder of Frank Olson? Because they were risking their lives by giving you the information.
Well, they were. And I was fortunate enough to know one of these individuals pretty well. And I'd known this person almost all my life. And the second person was a friend of his. And that became a very thorny issue, because there was never any intent whatsoever of having anybody know about their existence. And what happened, I was able to prove the case of murder even without acknowledging their help. But what had happened in the early 1990s, the district attorney in New York reopened an investigation into Olson's death because they suspected it had been murder. And that was right in the middle of my writing the book. And unfortunately, somebody told the district attorney was Robert Morgenthau at that point in time. Somebody told him, they said, well, look, Hank Alberelli in Florida has been digging into this case. for about 6 years now, and he has some very good sources, and you need to go talk to him and talk to his sources. And so one day I was working on the book, and the phone rang, and it was an assistant district attorney in New York introducing himself, asking me if I'd come to New York and talk to them. And initially I said no. I said, I've been working quietly on this book, and the book's almost done, and, you know, I'll be glad to give you an advance copy as soon as it's finished, but I'd rather not become part of the investigation because I'm trying to, you know, be neutral and maintain my objectivity here. And I said, I understand that you're trying to prove murder. And I said, but I will tell you, you're on the right path. But they were very persistent and called me every other day for about 4 weeks, maybe 5 weeks. And finally, reluctantly, I agreed to go up to New York. And I said, and they knew about my sources. And I said, but here's the thing. I said, I can't tell you who my sources are. I said, if I tell you who my sources are, that's tantamount to signing a death warrant with these guys. I said, they've taken solemn oaths with the government, and the only reason they're talking a little bit about this is because they feel pretty bad about what had happened, and they'd really like to see the truth come out before they die. And the district attorney's office said, oh, no problem, no problem. We just like to make sure we're on the right path, and maybe you can give us some other names and what have you. So I went up to New York for a few days, and I met with them, and I basically laid the whole thing out after they agreed to keep it confidential until my book came out. I told them basically everything except for the names of the two sources, and at that meeting they were very thankful, and they said, oh, this is great, you know, and now we can, you know, do our investigation. And so I came back to Florida feeling pretty good about it, and then about 3 or 4 days later, I was recontacted by them, and the attitude had changed a little bit, and they said, well, look, we have to have your sources. And I said, well, you know, I thought we had an understanding. I told you, I can't give you the names of my sources. And so they said, well, what if we met with them? What if we came down there and met with them, and they just put bags over their heads or whatever? And I said, they said, could you ask them if we could do that? And I said, sure, I'd be happy to ask them. I said, but I'll tell you right now, they're not going to do it. I said, that's kind of silly. And so it did get that far. But eventually, what was said, they contacted me again about 2 weeks later, and they said, well, we at least have to have proof that these two fellows worked for the CIA. And I didn't think that was going to go anywhere, but I talked to both men, and they did offer proof. And they said, we're not going to give you anything with our names on it, but we'll give the district attorney's office enough in the way of material so that they know without doubt that we worked for the CIA, that we had worked for the CIA. And that happened, and the district attorney's office was very content with that for about a week. And then they said, well, now we know they worked for the CIA, and so now what we'd really want them to do is to give affidavits. And I said, you know, I told them at that point in time, I said, look, I know what an affidavit is. I said, an affidavit's no good without somebody's signature on it. And I said, they're just not going to do this. And we went around and around. The whole exercise got very, very silly. And I finally said, look, this is not going to go anywhere. You have all the information, including the names. At that point in time, they had the names of the two men who had killed Olson, and there was even some suspicion that one of these men was still alive and living in a small town in New Hampshire. And they had the name of a doctor who had had never been revealed until my book came out, who had worked in New York and had been present when Olson was brought to New York a couple days before his death. And I told them, go talk to Dr. X, and, well, he knows the whole story.
We're running out of time. I really want to get to the thing. The reason they had to kill him was because they felt he was a loose cannon. He would reveal some of the CIA secrets. And when, of course, you assign these loyalty oaths and you reveal some of the information, they're going to kill you. Was that pretty well what it was all about? They had to get rid of him.
That's exactly what it was
about. And they went into the room, and did they drug him, or did they just throw him out the window?
No, what was going to happen with Olson is the plan was not to throw him out the window, but he was in New York for several days, and Olson reached the point where he knew he was in serious, serious trouble and was probably going to be killed. And two nights before he was killed, he escaped from the room, and with every intent of leaving New York City and perhaps going home and getting his family and trying to disappear. But he was apprehended by the CIA and brought back to the room. And so on the night he was murdered, what the plan was to take him to a mental institution in Rockville, Maryland, where he was going to be confined for weeks. And he knew about that plan at that point in time, and he tried to escape again. And in the struggle that ensued in the room, he was thrown through the window.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not imaginary. These things really happen in America, and you're never going to hear this on the major media. Well, Hank, it's really, you did a magnificent job writing that book, and it's I've really enjoyed writing it and reading it, and I do hope we can get you onto our other programs. I do 5 hours of talk radio a day, and we have a weekend program as well. What part of the country do you live in?
I live in Florida. I'm in a small town called Indian Rocks Beach.
Well, if it's all right, I will call you and we'll line you up for our other program.
Sure, that would be great.
Carry the book. It's going to have difficulty getting it circulated. The Trindale will do the best job that they can, but we'll do the best job we can, too.
Excellent.
It's a very important book, and we'll get your story heard as far and wide as we possibly can. Have you had any repercussions since you wrote the book?
Not really yet. There's been a few good things that have happened. I don't want to name the person. I actually got an email a couple of weeks ago from a reporter with the New York Times who, I guess, felt guilty that the Times hadn't done anything, and he tried to explain to me that he wanted to do a story. He very much wanted to do a story, but he told me he couldn't sell it to his editors. And I emailed him back. I said, I think that's kind of ludicrous. I said, in 1975, the Times was all over the Olson story, and they were pretty much a big part of selling it as a suicide, even though they covered the LSD dimensions of the story. And I said, you know, if your editors were really sincere, I think they'd go ahead and do the story.
But they wouldn't dare, because the last thing they want to know, the people to know, is that the CIA kills people
here
in America.
That's exactly right.
And that's what they cannot let people understand.
That's exactly right. They don't want to be responsible for writing anything that indicates to anyone in this country that the CIA is willing to go to the extent of killing another American citizen.
Well, I think it's an important story to get out, and I think you're very, very courageous to have written it. I just we'll put you on our prayer list, because I think it's important.
Well, I appreciate that.
Because basically, of course, I'm on the front lines of this battle 5 hours a day, and we say a lot of things, but we've got thousands of people across America praying for us. Kept us up. Because I do really believe there's supernatural forces behind everything going on.
I do, too. Absolutely. And I think those forces will win eventually, but it could get messy in the process.
Well, I think we're into exciting times, so I think your book's an important part of the armamentarium. And incidentally, we will be carrying the book. Do you have any website or anything you'd like to get out?
I have a personal website that's just www.alborelli.net.
Alborelli.net.
And then there's a book website, and it's just www.aterriblemistake.com.
Okay, hold on here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, you can go to the book website. It's www.aterriblemistake.com. We will be carrying the book. We think it's an important book. We don't have it in stock, but fortunately, we're in the certainly good relationship with the people at Trinity, so we will carry the book, and it'll be available to Radio Liberty. Hey, thank you so very much for being with
thank
us.
Thank you very much. I deeply appreciate it.
You did a great job on that book. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly the book is A Terrible Mistake. It's the story of the murder of Frank Olson, a scientist who worked for the government who unfortunately told somebody about some of the criminal activity in which he'd been involved. He was certainly very disillusioned with what he was doing. They were killing people. He didn't want any part of it, and he tried to get out, and it cost him his life. A Terrible Mistake, The Murder of Frank Olson, a book you'll be able to get from Radio Liberty by calling 1-800-544-8927. Please don't call tonight because they don't know about that, but we will have the book available. 1-800-544-8927. It was a terrible mistake. Now, certainly this is not anything new to me. We have a four-tape set called The Deadly Assassins where I actually talk to two CIA assassins. We interview the man who tracked down the man who was paid to kill General Patton. We carry the book Target Patton. We have but this four-tape set on Deadly Assassins. You need to hear it. You need to understand this is not imaginary. It is the real world. If you haven't read Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins or heard our four-tape set, Economic Hitman, my interviews with John Perkins, and he tells how they, the CIA, and he worked for the intelligence agency, and they would send people throughout the world, and they would either get wars going or revolutions, or they would kill national leaders who would go along with what was going on. I mean, he was such a danger to the intelligence agency, the CIA posted several pages about John Perkins on the CIA, pardon me, on the State Department website, trying to discredit him, saying all these nasty things about him. And then, of course, when it got so much play all throughout the world, and the book became a bestseller and all throughout the world, and millions of copies were sold, the CIA, the State Department had to pull down the website. We do have copies of it, but you have to understand these things really happen in America. And so we hope, ladies and gentlemen, you want to get this book, A Terrible Mistake. You want to get the four-tape set that we have on the Deadly Assassins. You certainly want to get the material we have. Is there really a war on drugs? Ladies and gentlemen, the largest dispenser of drugs in the world is our own Central Intelligence Agency. Why do you think our troops are over there in Afghanistan today? Guarding the poppy fields. When the wicked Taliban were in charge, they closed down the poppy manufacture. Now that the courageous American forces are there, and they are courageous, they're good boys, they're just simply being used in this whole deadly game. But now that the Americans are there, why they're guarding the poppy fields, the largest source of opium anywhere in the world, corrupting the whole world, but bringing billions of dollars to the dark side of our invisible government, or the Brotherhood of Darkness. We have a book called Drugging America, another one book on Defrauding America. We have a four-tape set on Is There Really a War on Drugs? We'll actually hear of Bill Clinton talking about MENA Airport when he was the governor, where they were bringing drugs in. And you'll hear Bill Clinton saying, but that wasn't my operation. That was a federal operation. That's the four-tape set. Is There Really a War on Drugs? You want to get the four-tape set, The Men We Left Behind. It goes into the background of what happened in Vietnam. How, of course, they were shipping American boys back home with their guts taken out and their bellies packed with drugs. Articles written, the tape you want to get is the one with Monica Jensen Stevenson, formerly a producer for CBS, who wrote the book Kissed the Boys Goodbye, and talked about the CIA and drugs. And that's the four-tape set on The Men We Left Behind. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR.
Mm-hmm.